Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Colombia is rocked by deadly protests. From poverty to police violence, we hear how COVID has unleashed demonstrators determined to hold their government's feet to the fire. Then,
every day, with the daily cases continuing to fall, we are hopeful about these really encouraging trends.
Americans start to see light at the end of the tunnel. But did the pandemic have to be so bad? Best-selling author Michael Lewis explains why he thinks the system failed in his new book, Premonition. Plus,
this is not the usual suspects.
Profiling the insurrectionists, Professor Robert Pape tells Michel Martin his study reveals they are not the people one might expect.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Discontent is boiling over in Colombia. At least 24 people are dead after 8 days of protest and a brutal crackdown in that Latin American nation. Now the Interior Minister has come out to say that the government does not condone violence and that any police officer violating the law will be held to account. The demonstrations were sparked by a proposed tax hike that the president has now cancelled. But protesters are not letting up. Colombians are desperate for better lives after COVID made an already dire economic situation even worse. This stunning statistic perhaps puts it into perfect perspective. More than 40% of the population now is living in poverty. With the same underlying forces present across much of the region, concern is growing that the unrest could soon spread. So let's go straight to the capital, Bogota, and to Mayor Claudia Lopez Hernandez. Mayor Lopez, welcome to the program. Let me just ask you to tell me about the situation in the capital. Is it calmer? Are there still protests? Do you have an issue of violence right now?
Christian, it's a great pleasure to talk to you, and thank you so much for the opportunity. It has been 8 days of protests in Bogota, two of them extremely violent, unfortunately. The demonstrators has been pacific. It's mostly young people who try to raise their voice and their claims. Unfortunately, in other cities in Colombia, 24 people has been killed. Fortunately enough, none of them in Bogota, but it does not mean that some riots and violence and also police abuse has been occurred in the capital. What we need at this moment is calm, a political agreement, to hear the voice of the young protesters in the streets that unfortunately has not been invited yet by the president.
So tell us, Mayor, what the young people want. And have you ever seen, either as mayor or in your career or in your lifetime, this kind of protest on the street in your capital and elsewhere around the country?
Yes, I mean, this is, social movements in Bogota and in Colombia are extremely powerful. They march, they raise their voice. I've been part of that social movement. I was also young, 30 years ago, and I was part of the student movement in Colombia. We claim peace, we claim inclusion. It's mostly a pacific movement, but unfortunately there are, some violence and some riots that end in violence. Last year, in September, we have a very critical situation in Bogota in which, because of a George Floyd type of abuse in Bogota, there were riots, extremely violent, and police officers indiscriminately shooting people in my city, 10 young members of my city were killed. More than 300 were wounded. So I denounced this nationally, internationally. I confronted both the police, which is a national police. We don't have local police in Bogota, and the president. And we were able, as city, to enforce some agreements to reduce violence, to prevent police abuse and violence in my city. Unfortunately enough, that has been, you know, useful for these times. Nobody has been killed in Bogota in 8 days of protest. But unfortunately, 24 people in my country has been killed. What young people want? They want inclusion. At this moment, they have high levels of poverty, high levels of unemployment. This is an extreme, unequal society. And they want to be heard. They want to be heard at the table with the president, not only with political parties or other social forces, but young themselves. They want to be empowered and heard, and their voice has to be heard at the national level and the national government.
So what do you make of, I mean, would you say their voice has been heard, the fact that they've been on the streets, they've said no to the president's proposed tax hike, in part, he said, to fill the economic gap left by COVID and the economic collapse. Would you say their voice has been heard because he's pulled that tax reform? And do you expect them to stay on the streets in this case?
I mean, they were heard in the sense that the president retired the tax reform that they proposed. But now they have to be invited to the table to have a social and political agreement on how to build a plan to, you know, recover from poverty and to have economic employment again. So, you know, to one extent, the president heard the nation and heard the voice of the social protesters in the sense that they acknowledged, the national government acknowledged that the proposal of tax reform was not viable, and they take that out from the table. But now there is a political agreement that is required, because we still have poverty, we still have unemployment, we still have a huge social and economic crisis. So youth people, social forces, political forces, and the national government, they have to come up with a plan. They have to agree on a recovery plan. That's required. And, you know, there are some things that make that agreement hard to achieve. First of all, there has been violence against the youth people. So, you know, they suffer. They are sort of radical at the moment. On the other extent, we are, you know, a year to go to national elections. So there are a lot of, you know, political opportunism. People making calculations what would be better for them at the political campaign rather than for the nation to recover at this moment. So I think we all need to count, we all need to contribute to a national, democratic agreement, a kind of New Deal, right? A kind of Marshall Plan. That's what Colombia and, I will say, Latin American countries need at this moment.
Mayor, I've heard you say that, and it's quite, you know, it's a big ask. And of course, you must be looking north. You must be looking at the United States of America, where President Biden has done that kind of thing, you know, a New Deal kind of you know, infrastructure and the American Rescue Plan and all the things he's rolling out, putting a huge amount of money to try to rescue the American people after this pandemic. But your country doesn't have those resources. It can't do that. So how do you economically propose that the desperate need, and we said 40% are now living in poverty in your country, what are the routes towards rooting that out, so to speak?
First of all, I think we need to agree that at least 10% of the highest top 10% of economic people in Colombia has to contribute more at this moment. I mean, we have to be able to make this agreement, at least. You know, this is not the moment to enforce new taxes and new burdens over, you know, middle class or the popular poor class of our people. But at least the 10 top percent of the economic well-being of our society, they have to contribute more. Mm-hmm. Second of all, cities. We have more capacity to have debt at this moment. Let me tell you, for example, Bogota, we only did now 3% out of the 100% of our GDP, the city's GDP. But the national government owns 65% of the national GDP. Of course, the financial conditions that they have are very different from the ones we have. So we need Congress to allow largest cities such as Bogota's to have a contract debt now, to be able to build and agree with our city councils and our citizens a kind of new deal, an environmental infrastructure social plan that can provide employment for those youth people marching in the streets. So there are things that can be done. But the most important essential social and political condition for that is for political forces to act seriously, to invite youth to the table, to invite social forces to the table, instead of steering political radicalization that will end up in violence.
Well, listen, thank you very much for bringing us up to date, Mayor Lopez in Bogota there. And we are now going to turn to Moises Naim. He's a distinguished fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he's been listening to that. So let me ask you, Mr. Naim, to put that into context. You just heard what the mayor said and what's required, that the voice of the people, particularly the youth, needs to be included and listened to. Your reaction to that?
Of course, that's necessary. And a lot of what she said, the mayor said, makes a lot of sense and needs to be done. Every country that has been hit by the pandemic gets a fiscal shock, meaning that needs to boost public expenditures and while revenues for this public sector drop, and therefore you have a deficit. So in that sense, Colombia is no different. They had a pandemic shock that they need to bring back their finance in order. The problem is that they passed a tax reform that was skewed and clearly unsustainable, and in fact, they have withdrawn it. One aspect that was very interesting in listening to the mayor of Bogota is that when she described the situation, she never mentioned political parties. It's as if the country doesn't have political parties, but in fact, in this case, they have been absent or they have taken a low profile. And that is the case throughout Latin America, where political parties have been weakened, and now the streets are the main channel of to voice grievances that is common both in Latin America and around the world, in which the streets, taking to the streets, has replaced the role that political parties used to play.
That is so interesting because, yes, it was clear that she didn't talk about political parties and it was listen to the people because the people are out there telling you what they need. So how do you put this in context of the wider Latin American continent? Because, you know, there's a lot of discontent around, particularly exacerbated under the year of COVID.
Absolutely, Christiane. And Latin America is going through hell. It's a disaster. Latin America has known crisis, political, economic, social crisis. That's nothing new, except that now it is huge. It's an unprecedented political turmoil in all around with very frail governments in many ways, and a terrible economy. The decline, the consequences of the pandemic on the economy have in Latin America are some worse of the in the world. And listen to this number: the number of deaths of COVID deaths in Latin America is 35%, and this is a region that has 8% of the world's population. So with 8% of the world population, Latin America gets 35% of total COVID deaths. So that gives you a sense of the magnitude of the problem and the frailty of their economy. So, you know, it's no surprise that people are taking to the streets.
So, you know, you also have looked at, and we're trying to get to the big picture here. You have a theory that there is a debate going on around the continent based on the three C's. Just outline those three C's for me.
Conspiracy, you know, again, first, let's put it in context. We have had these kinds of street unrest throughout the region, even surprisingly in Chile. Chile was always presented as the star reformer, the best economy in Latin America, the most stable political system. And we saw a couple of years ago a huge street protest that destroyed the metro stations, and it was massive. And he's still there. And as a result of that, the Chileans will soon vote to elect the representatives to rewrite the constitution. And it has been the political order, the political system in Chile has been upended. So and throughout Latin America, you see these street revolts and these protests. And immediately, every time that it takes place, there is three theories. One is the sea of conspiracy. Immediately, so people start saying, oh, this is a conspiracy that has some Cubans and Venezuelans actively undermining governments that they don't like and that they want to replace them with their allies. So that's conspiracy is the first C. The other C is copying. It's copycat. They see the yellow vests in Europe. They see what's happening in Hong Kong in the streets that were now defeated and silenced by repression. In Catalonia and around Latin America, people that take to the streets, and then there is a copy, an imitation effect. And the third C is we have conspiracy, we have the copying, and we have
combustion.
Spontaneous combustion, meaning that this happens essentially because people are fed up and take to the streets.
Yeah, so I'm interested that you said you pointed, you know, further afield to Hong Kong and elsewhere, the yellow vests in France. Look, for a long time, Latin America was run by military dictatorships. Then they became democratic, and then the economy was you know, booming, and there was hope. And it was a real sort of, several decades of hope. Now it seems, according to what we're seeing, to be reversing again. We also see democracy and the free market and others under threat around the rest of the world. And I'm just wondering whether you think that this COVID-enhanced kind of erosion of democratic values and principles in many parts of the world is also an issue, and on your continent as well, or Latin America?
Absolutely, Christian. One of my main concerns is that in a few years, the number of democracies in Latin America will be less than what we have today. And that will be a price paid by pandemics do that. History shows that after the pandemics alter the social structure and political arrangements and are replaced, and democracies often do not survive. And so after pandemics, regions have long protracted periods of dictatorships.
Well, it's all playing out in front of our very eyes. So thank you so much, Moises Naim, for putting it into context for us. Thanks so much. So, if that's the situation in Latin America, up north, hope is on the horizon in the United States as COVID cases there continue to come down and vaccinations continue to ramp up. The pandemic has wrought havoc in America since March of last year, when then-President Trump at the time claimed everyone was caught off guard. Take a listen.
This was something that happened that was, some people would say, an act of God. I don't view it as an act of God. I would view it as something that just surprised the whole world. And if people would have known about it, it could have been stopped in place.
But some people actually did see it coming. The acclaimed author Michael Lewis, famous for Moneyball and The Big Short, has turned his eyes to those unsung heroes of the pandemic. And he's chronicled why exactly their warnings went unheeded. And it's all in his latest book called The Premonition. Michael Lewis is joining me now from Berkeley, California. Welcome back to the program, Michael Lewis, to talk more about these trends that you keep putting your finger on and telling us all about. So the last book was The Fifth Risk, and we had you on about that. And in that, you outlined how institutions and experts and the thinkers were being hollowed out relentlessly in the U.S. over the years. and that, you know, this could have been foreseen. Now it is foreseen. Did that book sort of come to play and lead on to the premonition which you've just written?
Completely. It was almost too easy how the two books linked together. The Fifth Risk, it just framed the U.S. government as a risk management enterprise. Forget about the rest of it. These existential risks that this enterprise and this enterprise alone can manage, among them the risk of pandemic disease. And it was, you know, the problem of the corrosion of those tools, and then with Trump, the complete neglect of them. The question to me was, it wasn't like, is something bad going to happen, but when, and what it's going to be. And it happened to have been a pandemic. It was really the first like management challenge that Trump really faced, and it was catastrophic. So yes, when the pandemic, at the start of the pandemic, I thought, well, this is the thing that happened, and let's see how it plays out. Let's see if the things we learned about the federal risk management tools, you know, are relevant here. Mm-hmm.
Well, because in fact, you know, we all have been told that America was the number one most prepared nation for a pandemic, and it would be able to, you know, to deal with whatever came its way in this situation. And yet, it didn't, obviously.
It's incredible, actually, right? I mean, that a collection of, you know, hundreds of experts and researchers in June in 2000 through 2019 set out with money from the Nuclear Threat Initiative to analyze how countries are going to respond to this and who's most prepared and rank them. And the United States and the United Kingdom end up 1 and 2 in the rankings. Now, you know, as of my writing, the United States had roughly 4% of the world's population and a bit more than 20% of the deaths. And it really is, it really reminded me of like these college football preseason rankings where people go in and like some, and the big fancy schools get overrated. And then when the games are played, it doesn't work out. And it raises this question, like what is preparedness? Like what is managing this risk? It isn't simply having the smartest people in the most microbiology labs and the most material resources. There is this kind of management aspect to it that the rankings neglected and that these two societies really failed at.
Yeah, because here in the UK, obviously, you know, experienced the worst of it in terms of Europe. So exactly what you're saying, the first two practically did the worst. Can I ask you, though, to go back? And you start by going back to basically 2000. And you look at the situation there at the time, obviously nearly post 9/11, the obsession with terrorism and all the other things that were on the agenda for the Bush administration. And yet you talk about how at that time, the start of a kind of pandemic management was initiated. And you talk about some unsung heroes. Walk us through that.
This to me was an incredible part of the story. It's like the backstory of the pandemic is more interesting than the pandemic. George Bush, in 2006, is handed a book, or maybe it was late 2005, handed a book called The Great Influenza by John Barry. And he reads it, and it's about the 1918 pandemic. And he comes back from reading it and asks someone in the White House, what's the pandemic plan? And comes the answer, we don't have one. And there's this, you know, he has 9/11 in the recent rearview mirror, and he's got Katrina on his desk, and he's kind of wondering what on earth is going to happen next. And there's this scramble. And it showed you, like, how fast the U.S. government can move if the president is really motivated, because in a matter of a couple of weeks, he's got Congress to appropriate $7 billion to go and create a pandemic plan, a strategy, and all the things that follow from the strategy. And they bring in, this is what was so fascinating to me, a kind of, you know, an unexpected collection of people from various federal agencies nominated by their agency because they're kind of creative, different thinkers. Like, we're going to think about this problem for the first time. We're going to invent pandemic planning. And the character, the two characters who end up in the middle of it, trying to solve, there are lots of pieces of this, right? It's like vaccine preparedness and what do you do with animals, and it's endless. But the question of what do you do to preserve, to save human life and prevent illness before you have drugs, before you have vaccines, and before you have antivirals? That was the question that preoccupied two doctors, Carter Mesher and Richard Hatchett. And they were just doctors. I mean, smart doctors, but interesting-minded doctors, but doctors. And they groped their way to this idea of the social distancing, to targeted social interventions and the effects the particular interventions have on disease. Mm-hmm. And the whole world at that point is skeptical of this. The conventional wisdom out of 1918 was none of that works. You're actually not going to slow a virus. And they persuade, Carter Mesher especially, persuades the U.S. public health infrastructure that this is smart. He embeds it in a plan he writes with Hatchett in the CDC, and the CDC sells it to the rest of the world. So you can draw a line between the work they did back then and the global response to this thing. And the irony, and Carter Mesher would say is the tragedy, is that the country that sort of created this playbook, the United States, didn't really follow it, not nearly as well as the other countries.
Right.
You know, for him, it's an incredibly emotional thing. His mother dies of COVID. But it's because these truths he sort of unearthed about how you deal with such a thing didn't get formally fully acknowledged by the society in which he created them.
And then the question is why, right? We've had Richard Hatchett on this program,
yeah.
And I think the whole concept of tracing where social distancing comes from was just fascinating, and we did it quite early on in the pandemic. But then, and you address this as well when you talk about the CDC in your book, that it seems that politics got involved, you know, just on every level, including social distancing and masks and all that, including at the CDC, which you write kind of lost its way and lost its gold standard, you know, stamp of approval.
Lost its reputation.
Hmm.
It lost its reputation. And the thing that was so interesting to me about that is I just told a story, right? I mean, it's for you to decide what this story means. I told a story through three startling characters, including Carter Mesher, and you can decide what it means. But if you go to the ground level where disease is battled, with community level, and spend time with a local public health officer, and Charity Dean is the name of the character who mm-hmm. is my character who's doing this. You go. It's this problem with the CDC predates the pandemic and predates Trump. That the CDC had become, in her view, by 2000, when she takes her job in 2012, more of an academic institution. That whenever she has a battlefield situation with tuberculosis or hepatitis C or meningitis, where there's going to be controversial public health decisions to make to stop disease from spreading, they won't help her. In fact, they obstruct her investigations to the point where she bans them from them. And so she would have, if you'd have sat a local public health officer, you know, a character nobody knew they existed until this happened, down and asked them, you know, well before Trump, like, is the CDC going to rise to the occasion and be the battlefield commander in the event of a pandemic? I think they'd have said no. So you could see the seeds of the catastrophe in the lived experience of the people who are actually trying to control disease. And then we had this institution called the Centers for Disease Control that really didn't control disease. She, as Charity would say, she said it should be called the Centers for Disease Observation and Reporting.
So,
it's an excellent academic institution.
Right. And obviously under the Biden administration, they're trying to walk back and reprofessionalize a lot of these issues that you are correctly highlighting. And you've seen, as you said, you know, it takes a president with access to money and organization to get things done. You said about Bush. The same with Biden and the successful vaccine rollout and trying to reprofessionalize the CDC. But pull it back a little bit further, your lens, and it's really also about the American health system writ large. One of the reviews of your book said, the malevolent force in the premonition is institutional malaise. And the New York Times says, Lewis describes a healthcare system whose for-profit operations are so entrenched that hospitals last spring couldn't even avail themselves of a nonprofit lab that was faster and free because the hospital computers were incapable of coding for a $0 test.
It's amazing. Yes. You know, I do feel like the three characters I'm writing about are essentially describing the system by their struggles inside of it. And that you could see that you can see that the problems in the system have to do with incentives. And it is that a lot of the parties are incentivized just by profits. And some of the parties, I mean, academics are incentivized, like the CDC, by publication. There were too few resources devoted to incentivizing people to prevent disease. And so you had these mini catastrophes all over the place. One great example was what happened in San Quentin prison, that the third main character of my book, Joseph DeRisi, who runs something called the Chan Zuckerberg Biohub, who spun up this really fast, big COVID testing lab when he realized the CDC wasn't going to be able to test, ran around trying to give it away for free. And he went to San Quentin prison. He said, "You have a problem here, that if the virus gets in there and you don't stamp it out fast, it's going to spread like wildfire because just the physical conditions of the place." They said, kind of uncomfortably, "Okay, we'll do this." They did a round of testing. Everything was okay. And then they said, "We can't do this anymore." And he said, "Why?" And he said, "Because we have these contracts, paid contracts, with big lab testing corporations. And we're afraid of angering them and violating the contract." And lo and behold, when they turn to the big for-profit companies, the tests take 2 weeks to process. They're useless. And prisoners are shipped into San Quentin who are infected. And 20-something people die because they didn't avail themselves to this free service. Mm-hmm. And to me, it was what was interesting about this was the public health system in the United States had gotten to the point where it's like, yeah, we're starved of resources. That's one form of poverty. But there's this other form of poverty. It's your inability to take assistance or help from someone else because you're so unused to having it. And so when someone comes along to try to help you, you don't even know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. And so that was an aspect to the story.
And also the idea of, I mean, the technical term, I guess, loss aversion, the idea that, you know, making perfect the enemy of the good. And we heard from Michael Ryan, the doctor who's at the World Health Organization, in a press conference. He reflected on lessons that he had learned from Ebola. Let's just play what he said.
If you need to be right before you move, you will never win. Perfection is the enemy of the good when it comes to emergency management. Speed trumps perfection. And the problem in society we have at the moment is everyone is afraid of making a mistake. Everyone is afraid of the consequence of error. But the greatest error is not to move. The greatest error is to be paralyzed by the fear of failure.
So, Michael Lewis, that was a year ago, more than a year ago. That was March of 2020, as this was exploding into the, you know, into the world's population. And he nailed it on the head there. What's your reaction to that?
I mean, I have chills up and down my spine because it's the reaction of my characters. Mm-hmm. It's the way we've structured our political life to punish mercilessly people who are doing, experts who are doing their best in conditions of uncertainty, which is the inherent condition of disease management in the very beginning of an outbreak. It's fog of war. You don't know what you're dealing with. All you have is your best judgment. Mistakes will be made. But that we punish sins of commission, which are far less costly, more than sins mm-hmm. of omission, which people sweep under the rug, ends up killing hundreds of thousands of people. And it's breathtaking, this sort of, it's a public education problem, right? It's the citizenry has been primed to turn on someone whose mistake is evident and can be seen, even though the process that led them to the mistake is sound and brave, and not primed to see the thing that should have happened that didn't. Mm-hmm. And he absolutely nails it. He absolutely nails it. That's it. And it's sad. It's sad because people die.
Yeah, and you said something pretty sad as well. To an interview, you said something like, and I'm going to paraphrase, this is a story about superheroes, but the superheroes lose the war. The superheroes don't win. And I just wondered if there's anything, even since you wrote the book, and you're seeing now things get better in your country and in some other countries, is there anything that gives you some hope and some idea that lessons have been learned?
So this is, I wrote this book in a state of exhilaration. I thought that the people were so thrilling, and I didn't feel hopeless at all when I was writing. And I asked myself, you know, it seems like a hopeless situation. Why do you feel this way? And I think I feel this way because it's a bit like, to get back to the sports analogy, you've had this unexpectedly horrible season, and you're designed to go in and fix this team. If you walk into the clubhouse or the locker room, and what you find is a team that has no ability, no talents, you are depressed because there's nothing you can do. If you walk in and you find these people and you realize, my God, the talents of this society are unbelievable, that it can just be reorganized, there's hope right there. There's hope, the resource, the not the material resources, the people are there who can do it. And the characters, the specific characters in my book give me hope because they're creeping towards positions of authority again. And so I do think that when people get off their ideological stools and they aren't just yelling at each other about it was Trump's fault or it wasn't Trump's fault or it was a hoax or it wasn't a hoax, and I think they will get off it. I think narratives help them get off it, that you end up in a place which is a very American place, which this is a problem. It's a practical problem. This is a risk. We manage risk.
Yeah.
It has been exposed. Let's fix it. I think the Biden administration is moving that way, and I think they have the approval of the people to
right.
do so.
Yep, and I mean, you could sort of say it's a love story and a love song to the experts. So, Michael Lewis, thank you so much indeed for joining me.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, we dig now again into a study that's happened about the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Of the nearly 400 American rioters who were arrested or charged, 93% are white and 86% are male. That's according to the Chicago Project on Security and Threats. Here's Michelle Martin speaking to the study's principal investigator, Professor Robert Pape at the University of Chicago, with some surprising revelations about the attackers and their motives.
Professor Robert Pape, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you've said from the beginning, it's important to understand who stormed the Capitol on January 6th. And by that, you don't just mean for the purpose of bringing criminal charges. You've analyzed information about more than 400 people who've been arrested so far. And I'm being sort of vague about the number because the number changes, you know, every day. You know, some of the people have been in the news, like the guy with the fur hat, you know, the guy putting his feet on the speaker's desk. But you saw that there are patterns. The first thing, some things that anybody who was actually watching the thing unfold could see: overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly male. We could also see that they're older. What was the kind of overall sort of profile of the person who got involved?
What's so striking in this case is that two-thirds of the over now 420 who have been arrested are over the age of 34. We have the concentration in the early 40s. That is, people who are in their 40s and 50s. They have families. They have jobs. They are mature adults. This is a very different picture than what we've seen before. Further, when we drill into not just what we can see on TV, but with this large research team at the University of Chicago Project on Security and Threats, we're able to track the occupations. And what we find are 45% are CEOs, business owners, doctors, lawyers, accountants, mid-level managers. We have a State Department official. This is a very different pattern than we're used to seeing before. Only 7% are unemployed. That is the national average at that point. These are not people that are two, three times more unemployed. These are not people that are at the desperate end of the job rung ladder. And what that means is that a lot of our usual solutions just simply won't apply. So we usually think with right-wing extremists, well, let's get them a job. Well, somebody's a CEO or business owner, that's going to be a problem. What about trying to help them to adopt other significant others in their life? That's a big disengagement strategy in CVE. Well, if they already have children, already are married, this is very, and they already are in a good workplace, this is not going to work either.
And what about the militia attachment piece? That was the other thing. I think a lot of people would have thought that they were part of these groups that they may have heard of, maybe not don't know a whole lot about, but, you know, the Proud Boys, the people who are, you know, accused of, you know, desecrating these two historically Black churches in D.C. earlier in the year, or the Oath Keepers, or the Three Percenters. Well, you found that that's not the case. It was actually a tiny minority.
It is. It's almost 90% of the over 420 arrested for breaking into the Capitol. Now that we have half of those who broken in, you see only 800 broke in. Nearly 90% are not affiliated with militias or pre-existing gangs like the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, or the Three Percenters. This is not the usual suspects. These are not the usual ideas of the standard lone wolf, the standard militia group who's doing the standard far-right violence. This is not the case. And this is important because if we keep thinking it's the militia groups when it's not, and we keep thinking it's a lone wolf when it's not, then of course we're going to be surprised again.
So what did you find? In fact, you've been writing about this for the last couple of months, but it just doesn't fail to shock. You found that there's a primary driver that stands out across three separate studies, all with different methodologies. And what is that? It's one sort of overriding driver.
One overriding driver across all the three studies that we've now conducted is the fear of the great replacement. This is the idea, the great replacement is the idea that the rights of Hispanics and Blacks, that is the rights of minorities, are outpacing the rights of whites. And this is a consistent factor in several ways in our studies. Number one, we looked at the origins of where the individuals who broke into the Capitol, where they lived. And what we discovered is that over half live in counties in the United States that Biden won. These are not coming from the reddest parts of America. These are coming, half of them, from the bluest parts of America. Now, to be clear, these are pro-Trump supporters, so I want to be absolutely clear about that. But they're coming from Chicago, they're coming from Houston, they're coming from San Francisco, they're coming from Los Angeles and Beverly Hills within Los Angeles, they're coming from New York City. Now, this is, then we started to look more deeply, and we discovered that what do the counties, there are about 250 that have produced these 420 plus insurrectionists, what do they have most in common? What's their biggest risk factor? The biggest risk factor is not whether they're rural. The more rural, the less likely a county was to send an insurrectionist. It's not percent vote for Trump. The higher the vote for Trump, the less likely the county was to send an insurrectionist. The number one risk factor was percent decline of the non-Hispanic white population. The more the decline of the non-Hispanic white population, the more likely the county was to send an insurrectionist. And this would happen by chance less than 1 in 1,000 times. So this is very important to understand. Second, we followed this up because once we knew that, we wanted to say, well, gee, what would this, what's the general risk factor here in the population at large? So we conducted a nationally representative sample with the National Opinion Research Council. This is the gold standard of opinion surveys, not the kind of cheap thing that people sometimes do on the side. And we asked people, 1,000 American adults, we asked them, do you believe the election was stolen? And do you would you willingly participate in a violent protest? And what we discovered is 4% of all American adults, which equates to 10 million people, both believe in the steal and would participate in a violent protest. We further found that the key risk factor was belief in the great replacement. That is the belief, the fear that the rights of minorities were outpacing the rights of whites.
Well, is it a rights question, or is it just there's too many people here who don't look like me and I don't like it?
In our survey, we specifically focused on the word rights. So we specifically focused on the rights of Hispanics and Blacks, rising greater than the rights of whites. It's a clear core belief in the great replacement idea. And so that's why we're able to tie the studies together, so that because it's not just the general findings that overlap, they overlap very tightly.
What made you think about demographic change, the demographic change in the county, as something to look at? What made you think about that?
So I've been studying political violence around the world for 30 years. I started doing this when I started studying political violence in the Balkans, in Bosnia. Remember the Bosnian Civil War? Well, this was a conflict among Muslims, Croatians, and Serbs. I also study Iraq. I also study Afghanistan, where these are Sunnis versus Shia or Pashtuns versus Tajiks. So it was natural for me to include as one of the risk factors something about demographics. And in our country, the natural equivalent is the question I just told you about the rights of minorities versus whites. And that idea just comes basically is rooted in my 30 years of experience.
What you're saying here has become one of the key talking points of the right-wing media, is that white people are being replaced. But what does one do about that? Because the fact is they do have a right to say whatever they want, however inflammatory and racist it may be. This also comes at a time when there is no political will among people of color to, how can I say this, to attenuate their desire for what they see as equal rights in order to not scare these people. You know, you've got these sort of two competing movements here.
So now that we know more clearly and it's become more transparent, not just to people inside the movement, but to now all of us as a result of this, we can focus on understanding the fear. You see, it's not just an objective reality that's occurring here. There is fear that is occurring, and some of that for sure is being manipulated by political leaders, people in the media. I'm no doubt about that, what you're saying. But understanding that as a fear allows us then to understand and break that apart, not to see it as a glob or a blob fear, but we can then pull it apart. After 9/11, many people thought you could never end the threat of suicide terrorism. I was doing a lot of work on the demographics of suicide terrorists. That led to a lot of policies. And what's the threat of suicide terrorism today? Zilch, or near zilch. And I know because I study this in my center as well. So this has changed. The idea that we can understand more clearly the drivers helps us to understand the vulnerable populations who are really vulnerable to these fears. And then within that, to understand which parts of that are the convincible part and which parts are not. And this is how we make progress.
Is it possible that these views are more widespread than it would appear based on the number of people who actually participated in the specific action? As evidenced by the fact that, you know, the former president's continues to loom so large over, say, the Republican Party apparatus in so many places, and that adhering to this false notion that the election was stolen has really become kind of a core belief of the Republican Party apparatus around the country. So is it possible that this belief is more widespread than simply contained in the people who took this particular action on a particular day?
Yes. So, and that's one of the advantages of the nationally representative study is because I can tell you numbers. So we now know that there are about 4% of American adults who fit cleanly into this insurrectionist movement as of now. But there are millions of others who are just right next to this group who believe in the fear of the great replacement. They believe the election was stolen. But they say they're not willing to participate in a violent protest. And I would simply add, as the analyst, now. You see, when I study political violence around the world, what we see are what we call, and I hope this terminology is okay, we have passive supporters of a violent movement and we have active supporters of a violent movement. The 4% are the really potentially active supporters, but there are then others that are more passive. And the thing we have to be concerned about as we go forward is that some of those who are now have the same beliefs, but are not acting on them in the same way could become more active. This is what's making Jay Johnson, the former secretary of DHS, so concerned. This is what's making people who deal with disengagement from right-wing groups for years, this is what they do for their life. They are really concerned when they see the details of what we found, because it really is, as Jay Johnson said, it's frightening.
So tell me, you promised you had some hopeful direction for us. I think this is time to hear it. You say you think that these ideas can be intervened upon, or that this behavior can be intervened upon. So let's talk about that now. How?
So think about this like COVID. So when we first knew there was COVID, people kept saying, well, tell me what to do. Tell me what to do. Tell me what to do. Well, okay, political leaders told you what to do, but they didn't have any science, much science behind that. And notice how now that we have science, we can tell people, here's the science that will help us going forward. Well, that's what we're doing now with these stress testing. We're doing new research stress testing. The second thing that's very important is that we are going to assess, we need to assess the potential of the insider threat in the U.S. military. So even though we found only a little over 10% of the insurrectionists were members of militia groups, a third of those had former military service. This is a big deal, because even though it's a relatively small portion of that layer cake of the storm, it's a particularly deadly portion. It's a particular portion that is trained to the highest standards of the use of deadly violence in the world. That's our U.S. military. So this is something that we need to take very seriously. And it's kind of what we can now do is identify a particularly vulnerable population that we need to understand the scope and drive. Much, much more compared to COVID, it's like understanding preconditions driving susceptibility to the disease. So as we go forward, we also need to do more consistent and deeper studies all the way in the run-up to the 2022 election season. We shouldn't look at these as just one-off studies and now we're done, because the 2022 election season is going to be on us very, very quickly. And we already see politically it's going to be contentious. Well, the work I'm focusing on is how much violence should we expect? We know it'll be politically contentious. I'm not going to be in the politics of the issue. I want to focus We need to focus on the violence part of the issue. And we need to be doing this now routinely, not just wait until after an event happens and then people say, well, why did that happen? We need to act in advance. And this is one of the great things that we can do because we have the tools. We have that, we know how to make advances in our knowledge, and we just need to use science.
Professor Robert Paik, thank you so much for talking with us today, and I do hope we'll talk again.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Terrific discussion.
And so illuminating. And finally, a peek at tomorrow's show and my conversation with the inspirational and, it must be said, still impish Selma van der Peer. We talk about her life as a Jewish resistance fighter against the Nazis and how she survived the infamous Ravensbrück concentration camp for women and why it's taken her some 75 years to put this incredible life down on paper in her new memoir. Here's also what she told me about grieving for the family she lost in the camps.
Well, I haven't reconciled with that at all. I think of them every day, every night. Small things happen. And when I slice my bread in the morning for breakfast, and I half my slice of bread, I think of my mother when she buttered our bread. I can't help it. It comes into my mind. I try not to because I think, I say to myself, it doesn't make any difference. You can't make it undone. But I can't help it. I think of them every day in that way.
The memories. And you can see my full interview with Selma van der Peer on tomorrow's program. Also, we have the wonderful artist Maya Lin of the Vietnam War Memorial. She's joining me about her latest public work for New York City. That's it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.